That's really exciting. As I say, looking forward to your input as well. So at the moment, the prison population stands at around 86,000. In the last 20 years, that's almost doubled. So we're locking up a lot of people. Why has it increased so dramatically? Is it because crime rates have rocketed and we're living in a dangerous society where we need to watch ourselves all the time? Well, not according to the National Audit Office, who says there is no correlation between crime rates and the number of people in prison. So then, is it because prison is doing such a good job of rehabilitating people? 45% of people reoffend within a year, and that goes up to 58% for people who are serving less than a year of sentence. Added to that, last year saw the highest number of deaths in prison since records began. Suicides have gone up. Attacks on staff have gone up. Self-harm has gone up. And yet we're still sending people to prison. Why? I've been working in the sector, third sector, for the last 10 years. So I've worked with people who are involved in the criminal justice system, people who are struggling with addictions, people who have experienced homelessness. And what I want to share with you is a few thoughts on why it is that we keep sending people to prison, despite what I've just said, despite the high reoffending rates, despite the fact that the crime rates haven't shot up. The starting point, I think, is that often as a society, we separate people who have committed a crime. We treat them as the other, as different in some way. I don't know if any of you read the book The Lucifer Effect by Philip Zimbardo. I'd really recommend it if you haven't. He puts it like this: the idea that an unbridgeable chasm separates good people from bad people is a source of comfort. And it is for a lot of society. It makes us feel a little bit better about ourselves if it's other people who are committing the wrong and we can shut them away. Shut them away and separate them from us. But the problem is with that kind of thought process is it's that separation that can dictate what our prison system actually looks like and the way that we do sentence people once they've committed a crime. So, getting a couple of your thoughts. When you chat to other people, particularly for those of you who have been in a prison or have had conversations about the prison system, when you chat to other people about prison, what do you hear them say they think prison is actually for? What do they think the purpose is? Any thoughts? Punishment, yeah. Public protection, deterrence, anything else? Protecting themselves, yep. Oh, I had a couple of things there. Were they the same thing? Rehabilitation, yeah. So punishment is often the one that people will talk about, that, you know, in some way the moral order has been wronged, it's been adjusted when somebody's committed a crime. We need to readdress that by punishing somebody. That's the kind of basis of retribution is, you know, we need to make sure that somebody pays their debts to society and the moral order can be redressed. The difficulty with that is that punishment alone doesn't work. It doesn't actually change somebody. It doesn't actually mean that they're going to live differently. And then there's the deterrence argument, as you said. So if prison is so horrible, people won't want to go back. And yet the reoffending rates tell us a different story. And it's not that people actually want to go back. Every time that I chat to somebody inside prison, they say, I'm not coming back, I'm not coming to this again. And a high reason why people say that is because they don't want to let down their family or their loved ones or, you know, their community if they've been part of something. The difficulty with the kind of deterrence theory is that it assumes that everything's premeditated, that all crimes are planned, and that, you know, somebody's actually thought them through and therefore will make a conscious choice not to do that in the future because they don't want the consequences. And yet, as we know, the reality is that a lot of the people who do end up in our prison system are there having lived chaotic lifestyles, and decisions are made in a very quick fashion. Somebody's circumstances may drastically change, which leads them into that kind of situation. Then there's the just getting people off the streets argument, which a couple of people mentioned. I'm involved with a charity that works on an estate in southeast London, and we hear that from people in the community. You know, the reality is that there are some people who are involved in gangs on that estate, and it's a respite for the community if somebody's just banged up and they're away and they're off the estate. But what's going to happen after somebody's served their sentence? They're coming back out again. And if nothing's changed, it's all just going to happen again. Then there's the rehabilitation argument, which I think was interesting, was one of the last things that said, because it's often one of the last things that society can say, because we're busy focusing on the punishment, the deterrence, the incapacitation. The difficulty with rehabilitation is it needs investment. It needs a system that says we prize this and we actually are going to invest in this happening within the prison system. The latest prison inspectorate report says that 1 in 5 prisoners said they spent less than 2 hours a day out of their cells. Purposeful activity outcomes were only good or reasonably good in 25% of the male prisons inspected. So as budgets have been cut and staffing has been reduced in the prison system over the last couple of years, rehabilitation has had to go less on the agenda, because what are you going to pick? If your budget's been cut, what's your priority? Is it the rehabilitation programmes, or is it keeping order and keeping control and keeping people safe? That has to take priority on a limited budget and an overcrowded prison. The other challenge with rehabilitation in prison is it's prison. And that's the reality, is that we're still trying to focus on a rehabilitative system within a prison environment. So we're asking people to become contributing members of society within an environment where they're cut off from society. So that's always going to be a check. It's always going to be much tougher to rehabilitate within a prison setting. One of our other challenges is that we often respond to the crime and not as much to a person's issues or the issues that led them into committing that crime. So I'm sure you know the high proportion of people in prison who are experiencing mental health issues, high proportion of people with personality disorders. And often when somebody's sentenced, the priority is sentencing their crime rather than treating what the issue is that's led to that. The mental health teams within the prisons, because it is still prison that people go to who are experiencing mental health issues, there are very few now places and bed spaces for people in that situation. The mental health teams are overstretched and they often don't have as much resource to deal with the issue that the person is presenting with. Similarly, addictions. Again, you know, we often hear in the press about the number of people, number of drugs that are going into the prison. And again, our focus can a little bit be on the substance itself. You know, how has it got in there? Actually, there are some very ingenious ways that drugs get into prison. And yet, we don't think about, what about the addiction? What about the person who has come in with that addiction, or, in the really saddest of cases, actually gained their addiction when they're in prison? We've worked with guys who, they go into prison and develop their addiction, or it worsens within that kind of setting. Have you heard in the press about the kind of issue with legal highs? Yeah, so this is one of the things that the prison system is battling at the moment, and again, is a huge challenge for people who are working in that system to track what's coming in, but also the effects of what happens. So in one of the prisons that we work in, there was a guy that I heard about who, he took a substance, a legal high, and it reacted badly because you can't tell what's going to happen between one person and the next with a lot of the stuff. And he had a heart attack. His heart actually stopped. And they got his heart going. He was treated and then he was put back into his cell. And that evening, he took something again because the addiction itself hasn't been addressed. He hasn't been able to deal with the root of what's causing that addiction. One of our other battles, I think, is we can sometimes let the media dictate what our view is of people in prison rather than actually people, you know, meeting people and having our communication face-to-face and hearing from them directly. I don't need to name particular papers. I'm sure we all know some of the headlines that we read. And this happens really regularly, that you can read a headline. It's usually something about, you know, how much money is being spent of taxpayers' money, you know, to let people live in holiday camps, essentially, is usually kind of the stuff that we read. I don't know whether you saw, it's about 3 years ago, Gordon Ramsay did a programme called Gordon Behind Bars, and he went into Brixton Prison and it was great, actually. He started something called Bad Boys Bakery. Now, if you've not had their lemon drizzle cake, I would really recommend it. It is absolutely delicious. It's still going. It's amazing. He started this whole programme to give people an opportunity to learn skills and potentially want to work within that bakery within the prison and go out to have employment. What was fascinating, it was a real life, you know, the cameras were allowed to go into Brixton Prison. The governor had kindly allowed for that to happen. And he wanted to show what was really happening. But he fell into the trap, which a lot of us do in society, of going to the two extremes about what happens in prison. So the first week, he said, well, it's basically like a holiday camp. Everything gets done for them. They don't have to do anything. They don't even get out of bed early. And then the next week, he said, I tell you what, I'm in fear of my life. I'm going to be stabbed any minute. Now, I don't know about you, but if I book Butlins, I'm not expecting that one of the things that happens is that I'm at risk of my life, you know, as I'm walking around. But that's often what we go to. The two extremes is it's either holiday camp or it's just full of people who are so dangerous that, you know, we've got to be careful even being down the street with them. And that neither of those is the reality. And it doesn't take into account people. You know, the different people that are in our prison system are you and I in different circumstances. Have you heard of the comedian called Simon Amstell? He's a young guy and his comedy can be quite quirky. I was watching some of his stand-up a few years ago and he said something that really struck me. He was imagining a future where we'd look back on things that we realised were ridiculous. So things that happen now, and we'd look back and we'd go, what? We used to do that? And the first thing he said was, do you remember when people got upset about their pets dying? But then when other animals die, they ate them. And then he said, do you remember when foods became so processed that foods that weren't processed, we had to label as organic, as if it was some sort of luxury to not consume poison? So both of those get a laugh in the audience, okay? Both of those statements, people are like, yeah, that's ridiculous, isn't it? And then he says, do you remember when we had prisons? When we separated people off into cages rather than giving them the love that they needed that would have stopped all the crime? Yeah. And everybody just kind of looks a bit uncomfortable. They don't laugh so much then. They kind of go, what? And then he has to say, you're going to have to trust me on this one, because he realises it's gone down like a lead balloon. We often just can't imagine another situation. We can't imagine what else can we do with people who have committed crime. What else can we respond to? What has created a victim? What has caused a problem? What can we do about that? And yet there are alternatives. There are other solutions out there, but we're not investing in them. So the MOJ published their stats recently to talk about how many people are getting community sentences, and they've been reduced, despite the fact that there is evidence to suggest that they reduce reoffending more than a prison sentence does. But they've been reduced because it takes a little bit more investment to implement community sentencing. Restorative justice. There is so much theory out there. There is so much that has been talked about restorative justice, and yet nowhere near enough actually happening. There is more and more, and that is really exciting to see. And so, you know, I'm grateful for that. I think it's really positive to see. And yet there could be so much more. There could be so much more of that. A lot of the time when we're thinking about who's in our prison system, we assume it's people who have committed the worst offences. We assume that it's the people who are a danger to society, whether it's to us or to themselves, and therefore need to be locked up. Nearly half of all people sentenced to prison last year are serving a sentence of 6 months or less. So actually, a lot of the people in our prisons have committed minor offences. Have you heard of the criminal courts charge that was introduced in April? Yeah, no, yeah. So the Howard League have launched a campaign into its urgent review. And the reason being is that since April, magistrates and judges have been told, this is from the Howard League, that they must impose a mandatory criminal courts charge of up to £1,200 on anyone convicted of an offence, whatever the defendant's circumstances might be, on top of such things as fines, compensation orders, victim surcharges and costs. Defendants who fail to find the money risk being sent to prison. So our growing prison population that's already overstretched, we've got another situation that's come in that may increase the number of people in our prisons. A couple of examples of people who've been subject to this charge. A 26-year-old homeless man who admitted stealing drinks and chocolate worth £4.80 from a shop was jailed for 4 weeks because of his previous record and made to pay £150 criminal court charge and an £80 victim surcharge. A 38-year-old homeless man admitted persistently begging and breached an ASBO, prohibiting him from sitting within 10 metres of a cash machine. He was jailed for 30 days and ordered to pay £150 criminal court charge. Now, I'm really excited that there's reaction about this, that the Howard League are campaigning, that people are highlighting that this is going to cause us problems. And magistrates themselves are resigning. So, you know, I've read a couple of articles in The Guardian which is where people have talked about, you know, I can't do this job if this is what I'm having to sentence people to. The other challenge that I think we face in terms of the number of people that are in our prisons and keep being in our prisons are, and I kind of referred to this in my title when I said about, you know, why are we keeping locking people up but also throwing away the key? And what I mean by that is a number of people who have finished their sentence, served their sentence, and either been released prior to that or at the end, are written off. And we struggle to support people after they're released. So it's like they're still serving a sentence. It's like we've basically said, you know, you've committed an offence now, there's no going back. You know, we've got the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, which was updated last year, which was great to see, where people don't have to disclose their offences after a certain period of time, depending on the offence. But only 12% of employers say that they've employed somebody with a criminal conviction. So even though we've got an act that's designed to protect people, the reality is that a lot of people don't want somebody to work for them if they've got a criminal record. And I don't know if you've spotted on application forms, job application forms, but we ask people, before they even get to an interview stage, we ask them whether they've got a criminal record, regardless of whether it's relevant to the job. Now, I understand that in a lot of situations, somebody might be restricted from doing certain things. But there's lots of others where they're not, and we're still asking them at that stage rather than at a later stage, perhaps after interview, when they've been able to demonstrate some of their own experience and some of their suitability for a job and be on a level playing field with everybody else. Often what happens is they're discriminated against before they can even get to the stage of interview. And that stat says it to me, that 12% of employers say they've employed somebody with a criminal conviction, only 12%. Finding a home can be a struggle for some people. One of the things that I do as part of my job is I run an accommodation session in a prison in England. And whenever I go in, we chat about different options for accommodation and also how to maintain your accommodation. And at the end of the session, I go around the whole group and say, right, what is your plan? What are you going to be doing once you're released? And the responses really vary. So some people will say, oh, I have got family and I've got somebody to go and stay with. Other people will say, you know, I'm getting support and my probation officer's been brilliant and is really trying to help with that. And other people say, I don't know yet, and they can't tell me until a couple of weeks before release, the area that I'm even allowed to go into. So then there's only a couple of weeks to try and find somewhere to go and live. And I've heard probation officers say, you know, the fact that we're still releasing people on a Friday is tough, because if people are being released homeless on a Friday, that there is little to no chance of them finding somewhere to actually live within the space of a couple of hours. So people are being released homeless. They can't find a home to live in. And then the other thing that I think is a challenge in terms of the support that we're able to provide to somebody is the community. This is so key. If somebody is not going to go back to prison, if somebody's not going to reoffend, they need support, as we all do. We all need community around us. We all need relationships. We all need people that support us. And yet, if somebody's told that they need to go to a new area, and often that can be advisable because, you know, not getting in with the same people as before, potentially. But how do you build that community? How do you build that community if, as a society, we're often wary or fearful or judging sometimes somebody who has come out of prison? It's all a bit depressing, isn't it? But it's not. And that's the most exciting bit, because I think we have hope. I know we have hope because we follow a God whose justice is perfect. We follow a God who says that the poor have hope and injustice will shut its mouth. So what I want to do now is talk a little bit about what Langley House Trust does, which is where I work. And then I want to talk a bit about a few ideas I've got that we could all do. And I want to hear from you about your ideas about what you think we could do as well. So what does Langley do? We do some work both in the prisons and in the community. So in the prison, we run a programme that's 6 months long, and it focuses on somebody's attitudes, thinking and behaviour. So the purpose is to look at what has led somebody to that situation of being in prison. And that encompasses all sorts of things. So what's happened in their life, what's happened to them, what have they done, what decisions have they made, what circumstances have they been in, what are the way that they respond to certain things, and also some of the practicalities of, as I say, we do an accommodation session, and you know, we look at what's going to happen once you're released, how is it going to be different than before. We also provide some accommodation and debt advice in some of the prisons. As I say, you know, accommodation is a massive issue for a lot of people who are coming out of prison. And then in the community, we've got a number of hostels and houses where people come and live with us, either after prison or potentially sometimes it's either after living in a secure hospital or an approved premise or even in the community sometimes. But often it can be straight from prison. And that's where we focus on helping people to build a new life. And often people stay with us for up to 2 years, but we also have people who are elderly and who are probably never going to live anywhere else, and they stay with us and we love them and they're part of our family as well. We work with men and women, we work with the elderly, we work with people with multiple and complex needs, we work with people who are high risk, we work with prolific and priority offenders. One of the things that we are quite proud of is that we work with the people often who are the hardest to place. And those are the people that potentially would have either stayed in prison longer or in a secure institution longer had they not had a place with us to go to. And we love that. We love that we work with people who are hardest to place and that they can find a home and a support through us. The approach that we take that we believe makes a real difference is we believe in restoration. We believe in transformation. We worked with just over 700 people last year, and every single one of those 700 was an individual. And we look at what are the specific needs of that person. Where a system can often churn people through, we try and focus on what is your life, what's happening with you. We had a guy recently who had never had a birthday, never had a birthday party, obviously he'd had a birthday, but he'd never celebrated his birthday. And he celebrated his birthday with us. He had a cake, he had a celebration, he had a party. And it sounds so small, and yet it's not. That's somebody's life, and that's us celebrating and giving somebody the humanity and the dignity of having a birthday party. We worked with a guy not that long ago who, when he came to us, he had to be escorted from the train station because he couldn't read any of the street signs, because he'd never learnt to read. And then a couple of months ago, he wrote a card to the staff thanking them for the difference that they've made in his life. We worked with a guy recently who he's on a life sentence. And part of what he does now is he mentors other people who have spent time in prison and helps them reintegrate into the community. He's giving back from what he's experienced. We work with the community. We work with volunteers who come in and give of their time within our hostels, but also our prisons as well, where we work. And part of the reason for that is that, as I described, the programme that we run in the prisons is an attitude, thinking, behaviour. It's also, we set it in as much of a therapeutic community as we can. So the guys are encouraged to support each other and challenge each other and live alongside each other. So we take over a wing or a spur of a wing. And so that people can live in as much of a community as is possible. And the volunteers that come into that prison, they come in and they do the simplest thing. They just come in and hang out with the guys. They come in to chat. And it doesn't sound sort of transforming. And yet, the dignity that comes with that. We've got one volunteer who is in a wheelchair. And the time that I went in recently was timed when the volunteers arrived. And I can't convey to you the dignity on the face of the guys who went to carry the wheelchair up the stairs for this lady. It was just incredible to be able to see that just a simple act of somebody coming in provides humanity, reminds people of their humanity and provides that dignity. They sang a song to their volunteers. We did a celebration to celebrate our volunteers a few weeks ago. And they sang a song that said, thank you for bringing us normality. Thank you for reminding us of just what is normal. Just having a conversation, just having a chat and being spoken to normally. We partner with other organisations. We try and, as where possible, work with other people. And we also look for new ways to develop our work. And the reason being is that we're quite proud of our reoffending rate. So I mentioned what prisons' reoffending rate is. 45% of people reoffend within a year, which goes up to 58% for people who are serving a sentence of less than a year. Our reoffending rate is 2.6%. Now, that's quite different. That's quite different from nearly half of people going back to hardly anybody reoffending. So we know it works, so we want to do more of it. One of the things that we're hoping to pilot soon is the programme that we're running in the prison, we're wanting to run in the community. We wanted to put that in a situation where our biggest dream on that would be that people can be sentenced in the community. So it's an alternative to custody. Actually, that's not true. Our biggest dream is actually that there's no crime. However, before then, our dream would be that we are able to do stuff in the community that means that people don't have to go to prison. So, what can we all do? What can we all do about this? I've told you what Langley's doing, but what could we all do collectively? Can you take a few minutes, turn to one or two people next to you and just have a chat before I share some ideas? Just have a chat about what you think we could do about the number of people who are currently in our prison system. Okay, can I actually ask for a couple of thoughts from you first, and then I'm going to share some thoughts, and then if we've got a chance, we'll hear a few more. So who would like to share their idea or their thought? Yes.
Can I be cheeky and have two?
Why not?
One of us is a trainee magistrate and suggested we shut half our prisons, because actually if we shut half our prisons, we would have to, and we reinvest that money in community and third sector resources.
Love it.
I'm a probation officer, or more to the point, I work for what's now called, euphemistically, a community rehabilitation company, where my staff have got caseloads of 70. So somebody comes out on a Friday. When you talked about Friday releases, nearly half of people come out on a Friday, because anybody whose sentence should end on Saturday or Sunday come out on Friday. That's why probation officers hate Friday releases, because actually you get half the week's releases on a day when it's almost impossible to do anything if things go wrong. Today, my staff will be feeling even worse because Monday things are closed. So it's an even longer weekend. Yeah. So I was quite glad not to be at work today. One of the things that the community rehabilitation companies are doing, which I think is fantastic, and I just want to do a plug for this, is almost every person in this room, certainly every adult in this room who's over 18, could become a volunteer almost next week. Because what the government has done is said, actually, over a fifth of our budget is going to the third sector, and we're giving £100,000 to this charity, £100,000 to that charity, but expecting thousands of pounds worth of hours back. And the only way they're going to be able to do that is by recruiting volunteers. So everybody could leave Greenbelt and look in their papers when they get back, or email their community rehabilitation company and say, how do I become a volunteer? I'm from South Yorkshire, so it would be Changing Lives for Women, NACRO, it could be Inspiring Intelligence. There's lots of new charities out there doing really imaginative work. Fortunately, because my staff can't, because they've got caseloads of 70. But so there's two things. Let's close some prisons rather than building more. Michael Gove, only good thing I've ever said about Michael Gove is he has actually said there is two-tier justice system. He has recognised there's a justice system for the rich and there's a justice system or not, an injustice system for the poor. And actually, in that respect, he's a vast improvement on his predecessor.
Well, your team might be disappointed that you're here, but we're glad you're here. Thank you. Anyone else?
It just made me think when you said about volunteering. I think the appropriate adult system is something that is they need more and more and more volunteers. And there was a programme on Radio 4 the other day about if anybody can train to be an appropriate adult, because a lot of the kids that go into the police stations don't know what they're in there for. And if they're from a family background where they're not getting the love and attention from home, they're not going to get someone going into prison, into the police station. So an appropriate adult scheme is just a brilliant thing to volunteer to do. That doesn't necessarily mean it's helping the big situation, but it's something that anyone can go and help with, and they're crying out for volunteers.
It is helping. It would help the situation, I agree. I think that's a great thing. Yeah.
Yeah, on the volunteering thing again, could I just say a plug for Restorative Justice? Because I'm a Restorative Justice facilitator in Newbury, and this is where we bring together victims and offenders of minor crime and also do some neighbourhood facilitation work as well. And I think it's, you know, it's mostly with youngsters I've worked with so far. And if you can get the youngsters to take some responsibility for what they've done and meet the victim, it can certainly help them to be less likely to embark on a life of crime and so on. So I would certainly recommend people to have a go at that if they can.
Brilliant. We need a whole session just on that, I think, you know, on restorative justice, definitely. Okay, let me... these are all great. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I think it's great that we're able to get this on the recording for people to hear as well. I just want to share a couple of other thoughts on things that we can do, and then hopefully we'll have a couple more minutes to hear some more of your ideas. So one of the simplest things that I think we can all do is have some knowledge. So actually know what's going on in our criminal justice system. So know what alternatives are out there, as well as the reality of what is going on with sentencing, of what is going on with the prisons. Just increasing our knowledge, knowing about some of the laws that are being brought in and some of the practices that are being used and not used in some situations. Having a voice, I think, is really key. I know that my poor husband is probably very tired of the amount of times that we go to dinners and have conversations where, oh, she's managed to bring it round to criminal justice again. It's very patient. but actually, I think we do need to be talking about this stuff. You know, we need to be having conversations. And, you know, if we've got time, let's chat about the weather and house prices after. But, you know, this stuff is actually really important. Let's chat around our dinner tables. Let's chat, you know, in the pub and hanging out with people in the church, wherever we are. Let's actually talk about what could we do. You know, the reality is this is not, it's not black and white. And there isn't a nice, neat, tidy answer to a lot of it. And so it does take a bit of, you know, how can we share our experience? How can we understand a little bit more about what we could do? What do we think about this? You know, what do we think is right and wrong in these kind of situations? So I think, you know, speaking about it, having a voice in whatever context that we're in our churches, you know, where is our local prison? How are we supporting the chaplaincy team or any of the people that are working in there that might be in our churches? Have we thought about what support we can provide within our own churches? So, you know, have we done a simple assessment of what would it be like if somebody came into our church who had been in prison? How would everybody react? What would people's reactions be? What practical support would we provide? Would it be community? Are we welcoming? You know, is it okay if somebody comes in who's not quite, you know, as neat and tidy sometimes? You know, what does that look like for us? Or actually, are we brilliantly welcoming and everybody's welcome at our church and everybody fits in and it's awesome, but we haven't got any practical resources? So we need to figure out what's in our area. Who do we connect up with? Who do we partner up with that we can support people where it's needed? I want to invite Kat up to come and share a little bit with you. Kat is a friend of mine who we used to work together. We also used to live on a houseboat together. Kat is one of the most practical people I know. When I phoned her when I was on the way, and she's like, yeah, I just put up a couple of tents, somebody else's as well, you know. She's just really practical. But the reason I've asked her is not to give you tent putting up tips, is to share a little bit about her experience of supporting somebody within a church context.
Thank you. Also, to add my green belt fact that makes me really excited to be speaking here is that I came, my parents came pregnant with me to the second ever green belt. So I feel like it's in my blood. But yeah, so I was part of a church that was supporting men and women coming out of prison. And I just want to tell a very brief story about a guy who I'll call Eddie. So I've known Eddie probably for 6 years now. The last 2.5 of those, he's been completely clean and really is a different person. He's probably the person I worked with who I most thought was likely to not be around anymore. Like, he was closest to killing himself from drink and drugs. But he'd grown up in Scotland. He moved to London in his late teens. He was in and out of homelessness. He was in and out of prison. During that journey, he became an addict. We first met him at the homeless shelter that we were running. And he almost couldn't come into the shelter. He was so addicted to alcohol that he couldn't not have a can of beer in his hand. But he so also wanted food that we would persuade him that we'd keep his beer for him in the fridge. He could come in and have a hot meal, and then, like, we'd make sure no one touched his beer, and then he could have it again and he'd leave. He wasn't allowed to drink it in the shelter. And so he started doing that, and we started to build a relationship with him. And then it was a really long journey with him. Him trying to get clean, him going back on the drink and drugs, him getting into accommodation, him losing his accommodation, him deciding he wanted to go to rehab, making it through 4 weeks of that, and then walking and not managing that. And then ending up in hospital and being told he was this was probably going to be it if he didn't turn it around, and him deciding that he did want to turn it around, and he hasn't had a drink since then, and is doing brilliantly and is completely a part of that church community. And just to really, I think I was thinking on it, the four key things for me that helped us get Eddie to where he is now, obviously mainly it was Eddie. And Eddie also drawing on the strength of God, and that was key. He needed to want to change, but also we had a door in, so we wouldn't have ever got to know Eddie had we not had the shelter and a door he could walk through to begin to get to know us. We needed holistic support, so there was an addiction course within the church that we ran, but we also worked really closely with his homelessness kind of officer that had been assigned to him. The rehab he went to had actually been found by him, so there was that sense of holistic support both within and outside the church. It took a long time, and we needed to just stand with him in the good and the bad. And he needed to know he was loved through all of that. And actually the point when he decided that final time, I'm really going to do this, was when some of the people he'd got to know had come to visit him in the hospital. And he was like, I remember him saying to me, he was like, I just realised you really actually did love me. And so I needed to love myself and do this. So, yeah.
Just while I think of it, actually, just another quick story that involves Kat. When Kat and I used to live on the boat together, we used to have people around for dinner regularly, and we'd just try and fill our dinner table. We'd cram as many people around the table, and even if you've got tight elbows, you know, just to kind of share food and community with each other. And one time we had somebody who came along, and often we might not know people very well, and this person made some joke about prison food, and was waiting for a reaction around the table. So we kind of looked and was like, okay, yeah. And it turned out he'd been working for one of the companies that provides private prisons. And so we started a kind of discussion on privatisation. What was fun about it was, I'm not sure he'd quite expected it, but Kat and I were there, so we were working in the sector already. There was also a guy who'd been in and out of prison in the 80s and 90s quite a lot, and then there was another guy who'd just been released about 2 weeks ago, so it was awesome. It was like the best conversation ever about prison privatisation. Anyway, you've mentioned quite a few of you about getting involved with organisations, and I think, you know, we need to get involved at two levels. We need to get involved at the practical, so where we're actually directly working with people and supporting people, but we also need to get involved at the campaigning level and trying to change things, because the reality is some of the system needs changing, not just the people, and we can often focus on, you know, somebody's rehabilitation or making sure that person has changed, but actually sometimes it's the system that needs changing and that can exacerbate the situation. And so we need both. We need those two tiers, I think. And then also, I think, thinking about what is our sphere of influence? Where are we at and what can we do within that? So, for example, in our own workplaces. So, you know, have you got an HR department that you can go to and say, why do we have the tick box on the application form? Business in the Community and Unlock have got a campaign called Ban the Box, because their argument is to say we need to level the playing field a little bit more if we're going to give people a chance to actually get a job and not discriminate before they even get to an interview stage. Now, that's not to say that somebody doesn't disclose if they legally need to. They do need to, but we should give them a chance of actually getting to an interview stage and being met and having that opportunity before we then start making judgments on what has and hasn't happened. So the Ban the Box campaign, is that something that your environment could do? Could you go into your workplace and say, would we consider levelling the playing field a little bit? Or it might be that you've got your own business and you can provide opportunities, or again, campaign your HR department for opportunities for employment. These are a couple of kind of employment-focused ones. There may be many more in your context. What can you do within your own sphere? So we have got a little bit of time before I wrap up. So can we have a couple more ideas from you about what we can do?
Does it work? Oh, it does.
It does work.
I would first like to say that literacy and numeracy in prison is very poor, and I don't see why it's so difficult to put some money in and to improve that. Secondly, the criminal court's charge is absolutely wicked, and we all ought to canvass as many people as possible and get
yes
it
and amen.
Stopped and reviewed.
Definitely, definitely. Within the prison system, there is, I agree, and this literacy and numeracy is a real issue. There's a brilliant literacy programme called Toe by Toe, if any of you have heard of that. It's a great scheme that actually involves the guys themselves in becoming peer mentors. We've actually introduced that within our hostel setting and had an amazing... The example that I gave before about the guy who has learnt to read, that was through Toe by Toe, that was through somebody sitting and doing that scheme with him. So more of that, I totally agree with you, and getting rid of the criminal courts charge. Who else? Yeah, I think lady with the yellow top.
Coming back to something you'd said earlier about the wings that you run off prisons, I think that a lot of... I mean, I've worked a bit in prisons myself, and a lot of what we need to do is imitate more of a Scandinavian model. In our... My husband's heard this one a lot as well. is that the Scandinavian prisons tend to work more on a community basis. They're not locked in cells and on wings and only allowed out for 2 hours a day. They live in sort of... For want of a better term... They've got a house, almost, where they live with some other people, and they have to cook for themselves and clean for themselves, and they have jobs. Some of them in community, if they are safe to do so. Some of them within the prison setting, within the secure setting. And within that, I teach them that this is how you live. So rather than if you've been in prison for 10, 15 years, you don't know how the world works when you get out. And it teaches you those skills that you need to have to then move out. So I think we need to address that, but unfortunately it's a cost issue. And also a cultural issue that I think that Britain wouldn't necessarily go for. But by doing that, we allow people to have that dignity of, I go out to work and I have a purpose. So then when they come out, they're like, well, I just carry on as I was. I go and I get a house, and I, well, in theory. And if the world was perfect. But I go and get a job and I do that, and this is how life works. Yeah. So I think the biggest thing we need to do is imitate that Scandinavian model.
Yeah, brilliant. We in England and Wales have got one of the highest rates of imprisonment in Western Europe, and the Scandinavian countries, as you say, have the lowest. Exactly, yeah. Reoffending is much lower in those countries. And so we have to look at those kind of models as being effective, and they're demonstrating themselves to be effective. And so perhaps if we did take on board some more of that kind of learning... Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's exactly what I was saying about investment in alternatives and, you know, what we could look at for doing that. So, yeah, fully behind that, very much agree. The relaxed gentleman here, perhaps.
I won't sit up then after that comment, thank you. Okay. One thing, I volunteer in a prison myself and do some work with lads about their children. And it's often something that's overlooked, I think. I don't necessarily have an answer to this, but I think the percentages are about 40% more likely to offend if you're the child of an offender. And there's nothing, well, there's very little out there to support the children in families that have a parent with a prison history.
I think you're exactly right in raising that point. What's encouraging on that is people do seem to be talking more and more about the number of children. So it's estimated now, I think Bernardo's have said, that there's about 200,000 children who are affected by parental imprisonment at the moment. Now, that's massive. I think, I can't remember if it's last year or the year before, where that's actually higher than the number of children affected by divorce. You know, he's affected by imprisonment. And so, exactly right, we have to look at what can we do to be supporting children, to be supporting the families. If we do want people to have effective relationships when they're released, which is really tough once they've been broken, then some support has to be provided for the families. And actually, even little things like, you know, situation in people's schools, you know, if once kids find out that somebody else's mum or dad is in prison, then it can be really tough. So, yeah, I think that's a great point. Am I on, am I on time? I've got one more. Yeah, great.
Two projects that have really inspired me in the past was working with animals and people in... there's a project in prison in Madrid, and one called Pooch, if one, somebody wants to look it up. And they help long-term prisoners. Their therapy is working with animals, and they allow the men to train dogs. Dogs that have been picked up on the street, so they stray dogs, and it gives them skills and confidence as well. And the other one that we were just talking about with my neighbour here, your husband, was the Timpson, John Timpson, which is such a moving experience of a man who goes in, works with them, helping them to have skills, for instance, even cutting keys, which seems funny, and many other skills as well. And he follows them up when they come up. And I feel that our churches should be really, really challenged. I'm very blessed to belong to a fellowship that, where we do welcome people. And but I think our churches should be challenging us to be working, you know, doing what Jesus told us, not just visit the prisoner, but actually work with them as a possibility for a new life. Okay.
Oh, man, what a great note to end on. Thank you. Totally agree. Thank you so much for coming and for, as I said, being the hardcore who come and talk about prisons as their first thing. If you do want to know a little bit more about Langley, we've got a stand that you can go and visit. My colleague Sam is wearing a lovely Langley t-shirt over there, so you'll be able to spot her. Just chase around the site and ask her questions, maybe. But feel free to come and find out a little bit more. I'll be hanging around by the side of the tent. We do need to clear out because there will be another seminar in a couple of minutes, but I will be sort of a bit outside the tent if you do want to chat a bit more. But otherwise, go and act on some of the stuff that we've said. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Thank you very much.